Hello, I'm Oliver Colling, and this is my 70s TV childhood. Hello again, and welcome back to the podcast celebrating growing up as a child in 1970s Britain and the special part that television played in our lives then. As always, thanks for your comments and suggestions. I'm so glad that we're helping so many of you remember your childhoods in the 70s and bringing back happy memories. As always, you can share your thoughts on www.my70stvchildhood.com, tweet at 70s TV Childhood, or email me, oliver@my70stvchildhood.com. For this episode, we're going to be looking at what Sunday used to be like, and, not for the first time, it was a bit different in the 70s. For many people today, current lockdown restrictions notwithstanding, Sundays mean a bit of a lie-in, then maybe off to do some shopping at IKEA, perhaps followed by a late pub lunch before settling down to an episode of Call the Midwife or whatever comfort TV might be on. Not back then. In the 1970s, all shops were closed by law, and Sunday really was a day of rest, as nothing much opened up at all. Even the pubs were restricted to opening between 12 and 2 at lunchtime, and shorter hours at night with early closing. And indeed, in some parts of Wales and Scotland, pubs were not even allowed to open their doors on a Sunday at all, due to the corrupting effect of alcohol on the Sabbath. Families had to amuse themselves without going to B&Q, or the nearest designer outlet, and one of the things we fell back on was television. But even television was different on a Sunday. BBC and ITV had dedicated religious programmes as part of their public service duties. As well as having live Sunday services from around the country, millions tuned into the BBC's Songs of Praise to see churches packed with smiling congregations singing their favourite hymns. All very comforting, but not always reflective of the church's normal congregations, I think, as memorably satirised by Rowan Atkinson on Not the 9 o'clock News. ITV, as you might expect, had their own equivalent, but with a bit more stardust. Stars on Sunday featured popular actors and musical artists, either reading improving texts or singing religious songs and hymns. It featured some really famous stars like Bing Crosby, Johnny Mathis, Shirley Bassey, and very often Harry Secombe. However, its creator and first host, Jesse Yates, the father of Paulie Yates, well, at least he was until it was revealed that Huey Green was really Paulie Yates' father, but that's probably something for another episode. Jesse Yates left under a shadow after having had an affair with a young actress. And after that, the show was presented by a number of popular stars of the day, including Harry Secombe, Noelle Gordon, better known as Meg from Crossroads, and Violet Carson, aka Ina Sharples. There were also a number of shows aimed at a younger audience, and this is what I'd like to focus on for the rest of this episode. I'm delighted to welcome a very special guest to My 70s TV Childhood, Tim Worthington. Tim is a writer, broadcaster, and all-round expert on popular culture in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. As well as writing several books, including The Cambwick Green Procrastination Society, Not On Your Telly, and Can't Help Thinking About Me, Tim also hosts the fabulous Looks Unfamiliar podcast, which remembers the things that others don't. Tim is also the BBC's go-to expert on the clangers. And details of all of this and much, much more can be found at timworthington.org. Tim, hello and welcome.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me on.
Yeah, a pleasure. Now, before we start going on to what we're going to talk about today, you must be asked this all the time. But how do you become the BBC's go-to expert on the clangers?
Well, I'm not really 100% sure myself. It all just happened one day out of nowhere when I would occasionally get calls because I live quite close to Radio Merseyside, where a lot of the kind of national TV news link-up inserts are done from, or at least were before, you know, we stopped doing anything in studios for the time being. But I've done bits and pieces about things like, you know, when Trumpdom was back in the news because they'd remastered it, that sort of thing. Unfortunately, when a couple of people related to children's TV had died, they come on to talk about them and that sort of thing. And one day I just got a call saying, they're bringing the Clangers back. Can you come in and do 5 minutes on the BBC News about it? And I was kind of a bit thrown by that because if you've ever seen the appearance, and I hope there are no clips of it out there or anything, I had an appalling shirt on. I would have worn a better one if I knew it was going to be on TV, but I hadn't had time to read, you know, the beyond the headlines, the story of how they're bringing the Clangers back. And so I kind of had to busk it and, you know, talk about why I thought it was acceptable to bring them back, whereas I thought other things might not work in the modern context. And somehow I got away with it. But weirdly, they put up a caption saying Clangers expert, which I've never claimed to be. It's just sort of become that by default. I mean, I like the Clangers. I know a lot about the making of the Clangers, but I have ended up with this tag without seeking it. And all of the other things I'd like to be described as an expert in, it's never happened.
So it's not your popular music knowledge or your cultural stuff, but it's the Clangers.
It's not a bad thing to be an expert in, though. You know, given that Michael Gove is saying we're all sick of experts at the moment, well, you know, nobody's sick of this one.
Oh, that's fascinating. Just sort of by way of introduction, where did you grow up as a child?
I grew up in Liverpool in a very interesting time because it was that sort of weird limbo between, obviously, people have this illusion that, you know, when Liverpool was very big in the 60s, the money was there. It wasn't. But there was the glamour, there was the prestige, there was the fame, which kind of, when you look at it, kind of rumbled on a bit into the early 70s and it sharply dropped off. And then in the 80s, obviously, it was a very hard time. Particularly if you were, you know, leaving school looking for work, because so many factories, so many places of manual work closed down and were never going to reopen. But in between, there's that weird kind of vacant time, which is the 70s, which is what I was born into, where there was still the lingering kind of optimism and prestige, but none of the money. But people were trying to find their way around that. It's worth pointing out, you know, I wasn't a teenager in the 70s. I was very young. A lot of this stuff I just remember because I have a lot of older siblings. And as we'll come back to, we watched a lot of television. But people were trying to push past that. I mean, you look at all the Liverpool bands that emerged in the late 70s who, you know, they weren't just wanting to be famous bands. It was real imagination and sort of Echo and the Bunnymen, the Teardrop Explodes and so on. There's a show that Granada did called The Mersey Pirates, a Saturday morning show. So I actually saw in action at least once because it was, you know, involved the Mersey ferries and you could go and watch them from the dockside and so on. And it was an incredibly ambitious thing. You know, basically beaming a signal from the deck of a ferry to somebody standing with a receiver, apparently on a building adjacent to Lifer Building, picking it up, feeding it back to the studio. And not many of them exist now. And I've often wondered if that was because the resultant recording wasn't very good quality. But there was a kind of resilience there that was kind of chipped away in the 80s. I mean, you know, I'm not saying for a second I had a hard or deprived childhood. I did not. But my family's roots were in that. So, yeah, we always had an awareness that things weren't as they could be, things weren't as they should be, that in some ways, the North in general was being victimised, really. And there was a sense of that around while everyone was still telling each other how great we were, because, you know, as well as all that, obviously, Liverpool and Everton were both, I mean, they've had many heights of both being the biggest teams, but, you know, the 70s was one particularly big run of that. So there was a lot of optimism and, in a good way, arrogance without the kind of material backing up of that. And that became quite a big thing in the years to come.
Obviously, we're talking about television on this podcast. What influence did television have on you in your early years, and how did that work with your family?
Well, it had quite a big influence on me because I, from a very young age, thought about the mechanics of television because I remember things like, I remember being very puzzled as to why Brian Cant, who was on Play School and Play Away, also did the voices on Trumped and Chickley and Camberwick Green. I remember being young enough to wonder how it worked. Were they still making them? Did he finish being on Play School and then walk into this room where there was a microphone and do the voices? I remember thinking things like that. I remember seeing a bit of, I think, a repeat of Monty Python's Flying Circus in 1979 and wondering why John Cleese, who I only knew from Fawlty Towers, was in this very strange program banging a desk and people were laughing. And I was thinking about things like that, but we weren't really, I was aware when I was growing up that a lot of children were, you know, restricted in terms of they're allowed to have half an hour of television a day, maybe, and it was probably something improving, like Take Heart or that dubbed Heidi or whatever.
Yeah.
And we weren't really, we were restricted in terms of, you know, there were some things that weren't suitable for kids to watch and so on. But both of my parents were from the generation where, it wasn't the generation, obviously, where television was invented, but where it became affordable and accessible. And I think because, I mean, we had quite a comfortable upbringing, but they weren't from as comfortable backgrounds. And I think they both saw, you know, things like libraries, television, the radio and so on as what exposed them to more aspiration in life, social and intellectual, that, you know, it was possible to aspire towards things like, you know, being something more than a housewife, being a working mother or, you know, having an interest in science when, you know, you're from a background that wasn't really predisposed to. And yet at the same time, they could laugh at light entertainment, you know, like anyone else. And that's what I remember as a kid was being aware of, you know, because people talk about BBC and ITV households. We were both. We weren't one or the other. And, you know, I remember seeing bits of things like, I suppose a good example would be the, you know, the BBC presentation of the day, the Triffids, you know, seeing, being allowed to watch the opening titles and then sent to bed. But equally, at the weekend, we'd all be almost falling on the floor laughing at Russ Abbott's Madhouse. And I think that stood us all in good stead, but me particularly, because like I say, I was wondering about how and when these things were made, how it worked, what was, why were so many things sort of white background at the BBC? That fascinated me for a very long time.
Yeah.
And I think people still undervalue, you know, there's this incredible fear people have of the corrupting influence, in inverted commas, of, you know, whatever media it is on anyone who isn't them, basically. That's what it boils down to, really. You know, I'm clever enough to understand X and Y, but, you know, what if people who aren't me, you know, got to see this, that, and the other? And I think people still think that now. I think it's wrong because in the right way, television, radio, cinema, books, whatever, can be the single best education that you can have.
No, I agree. Absolutely. I mean, I saw into all kinds of other worlds that I knew nothing about as a child. And I think my parents were quite liberal. They allowed me to watch whatever I wanted most of the time, obviously bedtime withstanding. Yeah, you know, you mentioned that. I remember there were kids I was at school with who weren't allowed to watch TV at all. And you think, well, God, well, I go home and I watch TV. That's all I do when I get home from school. Yeah.
But even with that, there were things like, I remember a lot of kids who, you know, weren't that restricted in terms of watching TV, weren't allowed to watch Grange Hill.
Yeah, which, that's right.
You know, my mother was a teacher in a tough comprehensive in Liverpool and never saw a problem with Grange Hill. I think she, you know, she saw worse misbehaviour every day and had to deal with it. And we were never, ever prevented from watching it. And it was always strange when, you know, other children would be around and they would be asked, are you allowed to watch Grange Hill at your house? And if they weren't, we weren't allowed to. And that was always a burning injustice. I really resented that.
Well, it was revolutionary. Kids talking back to the teachers and smoking behind the bike sheds and whatever. As you say, it's sort of fairly mild when compared to what was happening in your mum's school. But we're talking about religious programming today. Mm-hmm. And one that sticks in many people's minds is the Sunday Game. And for those of our listeners who don't remember the show, can you remember what it was like?
Yes, it was the weird equivalent to, I mean, I used to be obsessed with television starting, you know, where you'd have the test card, which I wasn't dramatically keen on. I don't think a lot of children my age were. But, you know, you then have, say, a startup sequence if it was ITV, or a bit of music over a caption slide on the BBC, maybe a public information film, and then programmes that didn't seem to belong anywhere else in the schedules. I mean, obviously on a Saturday morning, you'd have, you know, repeats of the Monkees or the Banana Splits, or cartoons like, I don't know, things like the Oddball Couple that nobody remembers now. But Sunday, obviously they couldn't really, you know, because it was the day of rest, you know, and also there were quite serious restrictions on what could and couldn't be broadcast on the Sunday. So they would kick off with something like Bagpuss or Mary Bungo and Midge, you know, one of the more kind of subdued, cerebral Watch With Mother programmes. But then after that, you would get things like, there were a number of things like Wake Up Sunday with Donna, Knock Knock, which I think was a number of different singers singing devotional songs. But the Sunday Gang was ostensibly, I mean, they were all well into their 20s, but they were purportedly a gang of kids who got together in their clubhouse on the Sunday morning before your parents were up, you know, when all this, things like Land of the Laps would be on ITV. You know, on the BBC, you'd have the Sunday Gang, where they just convened to talk about Jesus and his teachings and how they related to their everyday lives in a very, very obvious BBC studio set of the mid to late 70s with a screeching Scottish puppet rat as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Macintosh, was it? Macintosh the
Mouse?
Yes,
technically it's Macintosh Mouse, but that is a rat. Nobody can convince me otherwise.
Macintosh Mouse. It's another one of these slightly scary puppets that used to appear on TV. I mean, in a previous episode, we talked about Hartley Hare in the Pipkins. He was quite frightening as a kid.
Yeah, they're very much in the Hartley Hare mould, because Macintosh is basically, I don't know, it's like a dilapidated pillowcase screeching the Sassanax. Actually, in a worse Scottish accent than Richard Herring's Scottish accent, which takes some doing.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the gang thing. I mean, why do you think the BBC sort of dressed up what was basically an evangelical Christian message and tried to make it a bit like the Double Deckers?
Well, there were a lot of gang sort of themed programmes in the 70s. Everyone forgets that now. It seems to have been the thing. I think it came from comics, really, because it was when post, you know, the Beano and the Dandy being the dominant ones, we started getting things like Core, Whizzer and Chips and Whoopi. They were always founded around a gang of some description.
Yeah.
You know, a group of kids that played together or had the same interest. And I think it stems from that, really. And it's a way of, you know, because it's a subject where, you know, most kids would switch on and think, oh no, it's about church, boring. But if they were trying to make you feel like they were part of their gang for various reasons, then, you know, you might be more enticed to watch it, really.
As regular listeners all know, I mean, my dad was a vicar, so I didn't always see it because I was in church at 8 years old on a Sunday. But actually, his sermons on a Sunday were less preachy than the Sunday Gang was, which is quite interesting because it's typical Church of England, really. But I wonder how successful it was.
Well, it ran for, I think, 5 or 6 years. So, you know, it must be doing something right. But, I mean, I would say the biggest indication of its success was, you know, we got bundled off to church first thing on the Sunday as well. We did not like it, any of us. We were not happy about it. The only saving grace was that, well, literal saving grace was that it was early in the morning, it was out of the way for the rest of Sunday, when you could watch all the other weird stuff that they put on the Sunday. Yeah. And, you know, as kids, we did used to say, remember that year when Christmas Day was on the Sunday, we only had to go to church once, which, you know, is hardly the lesson we should have been drawing. But we would willingly watch this programme before going off to church. Yeah. And we wouldn't have done if we resented it in any way.
No.
I mean, I have very hazy recollections of it from the very start, and that's mainly because I remember being hit by my elder siblings with sofa cushions who accusing me of loving one of the presenters of it, which... But I remember, because obviously it went on for a number of years, keeping watching it. Mm. So again, you know, there must be something in it that was enjoyable to people weren't really enjoying church. I am told that, because we had quite a relatively young and trendy priest who, you know, being me, I was always suspicious of anyone trying to be down with the kids. You know, it's a bit like that
kid, Steve
Buscemi with the skateboard, you know, how do you do, fellow kids? And later on, I remember him doing a sermon about, he'd seen the program called Captain Zepp Space Detective. And he said, I wondered to myself, if Captain Zeph went far enough, would he reach heaven? And I remember thinking silently in my head, stop getting Captain Zeph wrong. Wow. Zeph Wong goes to prearranged locations to solve crimes. But apparently he would sometimes reference the Sunday Gang in his sermons, which, you know, that's quite a big way for it to get through as well.
Yeah, it is. Am I allowed to ask which one of the gang you had a thing about?
Yes, it was Tina to Ease, played by Tina Heath,
yeah.
Who, watching it back now, people who know me will probably, if they saw clips of her, you know, with how she was dressed and how she behaves in it, would say, yeah, she's got you written all over her. I mean, their character is kind of a gobby, loudmouth cockney type. You know, basically, she was kind of like, you know, your best friend's girlfriend's best friend, and everyone says, you should get together with her. That's basically yep. Tina. And their role was basically to go, well, why did no one help that poor Samaritan? Why did that just walk past?
No, well, I mean, she was my favourite as well, because I remember her in Lizzie Dripping. And yep. I always had a bit of a thing about her myself. But then she met her future husband on the show, who was in one of the musicians, yes. And then went on to bigger and better things with Blue Peter. I was wondering, do you know what happened to the rest of the gang?
The trail goes very cold about them very quickly, because the other members were, there was JD, who was kind of the hey, everyone gets along type character, who occasionally, I remember spotting him in things like 2.4 Children and The Bill, you know, always in smaller roles. I believe he had a larger role in The Manageress, Cherry Lungi, that football drama on Channel 4. I don't remember him in it, but apparently he had quite a prominent role. Glenn Stewart, who was Boff, the kind of technical wizard who built the computer. Now, the computer we'll have to come back to, because that is remarkable, that. But he would show up in things. I remember him being in Help, the sitcom that everyone thinks Craig Charles was in. No, it's actually Jake Abraham, who Craig Charles comments himself on the fact that they look like each other. It's not that they all look the same thing. They do get confused quite often. But that was a sitcom about, as Craig Charles calls it, the three guys on the park bench looking for jobs set in Liverpool in the 80s. And I remember him turning up in that.
Yeah.
A couple of other things in bit parts. Jill Shakespeare, who was Dodo, who was like harder thinking country bumpkin one, who would have to have the parables re-explained to her again and again. Seems to have had quite a reasonable career in things like she was in Thriller, the ITV horror anthology series. She was in Against the Crowd, which is a Nigel Neal play. Wings, which is a very prestigious BBC costume drama. Did the Sunday Gang. Appears to have done nothing else since then. As if she got typecast as this hard-of-thinking country bumpkin type. Alison Christie Murray, who I think replaced Tina Heath when she left. This is her only credit, as far as I can tell. I don't know where some of them came from originally.
I don't remember seeing many of them afterwards, other than Tina Heath. You mentioned Boff, so he had lots of inventions and things. And the computer, tell us about the computer.
Yeah, the computer is basically some tape spools and piano keys done up to look like a terrifying robot face. It ostensibly played the theme tune, which, if you remember that, it will be burning through your memory now. But it was that's right. You turn around the handle and they would improvise a verse about that week's Bible story and then go into the knocking on doors, opening windows, up and down and round with kind of a hand jive dance where Tina Heath looked like the only one who was enthusiastic about doing it. It reminds me of actually, you know, when they do Tongue Tied on Red Dwarf very early on, the sort of song and dance thing, where obviously, you know, we've got Danny John Jules is singing it, and, you know, he was a singer and dancer. But in the background, I've never been able to decide who I think is funnier, out of Craig Charles looking like he's the most uncomfortable he's ever been in his life, and Chris Barry looking like he's never been happier. He genuinely seems to be thrilled by it. That's kind of what the Sunday Gang were like. They seemed a bit reluctant, apart from Tina Heath, who was actually punching the air while she was doing the dance.
Full of enthusiasm, which is great.
Yeah.
That's great. Oh, that's brought back some fantastic memories. That theme tune is going to be going through my head for the next couple of weeks, I think. Finding out the way.
the Sunday gang. Why don't you come with us today?
I always wondered about the knocking on doors was one thing. What was the opening windows about? I could never quite work that out.
I don't know. I mean, was it kind of letting the message of God in through the window?
Maybe.
I don't know.
Maybe. Or if you don't come to the door, we're going to come in your window.
I wondered if it was in some ways a kind of, we should just copy that but with slightly different words so nobody will notice, rip of the theme from Rainbow, actually.
Ah. Which, now, that's pretty good thinking.
You know, obviously, that's about, you know, far up the streets and houses and all that, but thematically... Yeah. And literally, in terms of the rhythm, they fit together very well.
They do. They do. I'd never thought about that. I have to take it that away and think about it. Well, that's absolutely brilliant, Tim. Thanks for helping us remember the Sunday gang. They're really interesting to talk to you, and particularly to hear about you growing up in Liverpool. But that's great. Thanks ever so much for joining us on My 70s TV Child, and hopefully we can talk to you again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us, Tim. And a reminder that Tim's Looks Unfamiliar podcast is available from all your main podcast hosts. And you can find out lots more about Tim at timworthington.org. Well, that's all for now. I'm going to have the Sunday Gang theme running around my mind for the next couple of weeks at least. If you want to share your memories of the Sunday Gang, or indeed any of the subjects we've covered, you can do so at our blog, www.my70stvchildhood.com, tweet at 70stvchildhood, or email me directly, oliver@my70stvchildhood.com. Take care, and I'll see you soon for more from My 70s TV Childhood. Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, you can become a supporter by visiting my Patreon page at www.patreon.com/Oliver Colling. There you'll find details of our membership options. And don't worry, all memberships are flexible and be cancelled at any time. Thanks for your support. It really makes a difference.